The first reading today is taken from 1 Kings chapter 6, verses 1 to 22. In the 480th year after the people of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, he began to build the house of the Lord. The house that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. The vestibule in front of the nave of the house was 20 cubits long, equal to the width of the house, and 10 cubits deep in front of the house. And he made for the house windows with recessed frames. He also built a structure against the wall of the house, running around the walls of the house, both the nave and the inner sanctuary. And he made side chambers all round. The lower story was 5 cubits broad. The middle one was 6 cubits broad, and the third was 7 cubits broad. For around the outside of the house, he made offsets on the wall in order that the supporting beams should not be inserted into the walls of the house. When the house was built, it was with stone prepared at the quarry, so that neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was being built. The entrance of the lower story was on the south side of the house, and one went up by stairs to the middle story, and from the middle story to the third. So he built the house and finished it, and he made the ceiling of the house of beams and planks of cedar. He built the structure against the whole house, 5 cubits high, and it was joined to the house with timbers of cedar. Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon, "Concerning this house that you are building, if you will walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will establish my word in you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel." So Solomon built the house and finished it. He lined the walls of the house on the inside with boards of cedar. From the floor of the house to the walls of the ceiling, he covered them on the inside with wood, and he covered the floor of the house with boards of cypress. He built 20 cubits on the rear of the house with boards of cedar, from the floor to the walls, and he built this within an inner sanctuary as the most holy place. The house, that is, the nave in front of the inner sanctuary, was 40 cubits long. The cedar within the house was carved from the form of gourds and open flowers. All was cedar, no stone was seen. The inner sanctuary he prepared in the innermost part of the house to set there the ark of the covenant of the Lord. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 20 cubits high, and he overlaid it with pure gold. He also overlaid an altar of cedar. And Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold, and he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. And he overlaid the whole house with gold until all the house was finished. Also the whole altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary he overlaid with gold.
The second reading is from 1 Kings chapter 8. Then Solomon assembled the elders of Israel and all the heads of the tribes, the leaders of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel, before King Solomon in Jerusalem, to bring up the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of the city of David, which is Zion. And all the men of Israel assembled to King Solomon at the feast in the month Ethanim, which is the seventh month. And all the elders of Israel came, and the priests took up the ark. And they brought up the ark of the Lord, the tent of the meeting, and all the holy vessels that were in the tent. The priests and the Levites brought them up. And King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who had assembled before him were with him before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted or numbered. Then the priests brought the ark of the covenant of the Lord to its place in the inner sanctuary of the house, in the most holy place, underneath the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark, so that the cherubim overshadowed the ark and its poles. And the poles were so long that the ends of the poles were seen from the holy place before the inner sanctuary, but they could not be seen from outside. And they are there to this day. There was nothing inside the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the people of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. And when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Then Solomon said, "The Lord has said that he would dwell in thick darkness. I have indeed built you an exalted house, a place for you to dwell in forever." Then the king turned round and blessed all the assembly of Israel, while all the assembly of Israel stood. And he said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who with his hand has fulfilled what he promised with his mouth to David my father, saying, 'Since the day that I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I chose no city out of all the tribes of Israel in which to build a house, that my name might be there. But I chose David to be over my people Israel.' Now it was in the heart of David my father to build a house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to David my father, 'Whereas it was in your heart to build a house for my name, you did well that it was in your heart. Nevertheless, you shall not build the house, but your son who shall be born to you shall build the house for my name.' Now the Lord has fulfilled his promise that he made, for I have risen in the place of David my father and sit on the throne of Israel as the Lord promised, and I have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And there I have provided a place for the ark, in which is the covenant of the Lord that he made with our fathers when he brought them out of the land of Egypt."
Bag containing exciting prop to be revealed in a moment. Let me add my welcome to Andrews. It's great to see you here. And we are continuing our series in 1 Kings. And we've got to the building of the temple, and I'm excited to be here, and I hope you are too. This is one of these opening illustrations that reveals my age. It's very dangerous to refer to kids, to TV programs you remember from your childhood, because I now realize that I'm probably older than half the people in the church. So some people's childhood, or at least some people's middle age, depending on your age now, and for some of you, while you're at primary school or before you were born, there used to be a TV show called Through the Keyhole. This point, I look around and I see some people nodding. Katie Butler, similar generation to me, yes. For those who don't know, it was a pretty simple premise for a show. Basically, it was about nosing around people's houses. And I presume that they were allowed to and they got the keys legit or whatever. But anyway, they looked around people's houses with a TV camera and you had to ask who might live here. And they found famous people's houses and there were various clues and they rifled through the guy's wardrobe, and you know, you could say, and then can you guess who it is? And then there was a big reveal at the end. Particularly famous because the host was a guy called Lloyd Grossman, who had the poshest voice, I think, of anybody on TV in the 90s, and people all tried to impersonate his voice. I'm not going to try and do it now. But it was called Through the Keyhole. You describe the house, and the question is, what kind of person would live here? And there are always clues around the house that told you about the resident of the house. So, for example, you know, there'd be a massive collection of cricketing trophies in the bedroom. That would be the giveaway. Maybe it's someone who plays cricket, and sure enough, it was Freddie Flintoff's house or whatever. Well, here's the description. It takes 3 whole chapters of a house. I mean, it's a through-the-keyhole look at the house. In fact, we don't just get to see the house when it's completed. We get to watch the house as it's being built and as it's furnished. And we get to be there for the opening ceremony of the house. And actually, to give it away, I mean, you already know the answer. Who is this house for? We're told it is a house for the name of the Lord. But what can we learn about God by looking at his house? By looking through the keyhole, what can we discover about him? And the first thing I want us to notice is that the temple is a really glorious house. It is an amazing, amazing building. It would have been in the list of the wonders of the world, except it was destroyed before the list was compiled. I think it would have headed the list. Now, I think the trouble with us is we read verses like this, and I don't know about you when you heard it read, but it can seem a bit dreary and tedious to us. Oh, it's one of those bits of the Bible that just contains endless measurements, you know, this many cubits by this many, and instructions, and we think, why do we care? And I think if that's our attitude as we're hearing it read, we haven't really entered into the kind of imagery that the author is trying to convey in our minds. So just a couple of things by way of introduction. Realise that people in these days didn't live in the City of London with a St. Paul's and a Shard and a Royal Naval College in Greenwich. They lived in tents or little buildings in Jerusalem, small little brick-built, stone-built houses. And this was a building like no other that had ever been. So just, I mean, I get quite excited even by cranes in London. I think, oh, what are they going to build? And you can go to the skyscraper websites and look at the shape of it, the next one. I find that quite exciting. But I live in a city with lots of other exciting buildings. Imagine this is the first huge, massive, glorious building that there's ever been. It's really exciting. Realise as well that you don't have cameras or TV shows. You can't see the pictures or the movie. And in fact, for certainly part of the house, you never get to see it because it's inside and you're not allowed in unless you're the high priest. So this is the one chance you get to picture in your mind's eye what it's like. Secondly. Thirdly, I think we're just not very good sometimes at imagining pictures painted by words. One of the things that most excited me about the temple is the pomegranates. There are pomegranates everywhere. So back in chapter 6, we discover that the top of the pillars are decorated full of pomegranates. In chapter 7, we're told there were, chapter 7, verse 20, 200 pomegranates in two rows all the way round. So imagine a pillar, and at the top of the pillar, a lattice work, and on top of the lattice work, 200 carved pomegranates. Now, here's my prop, which is I think, rather beautiful plate. I'm not going to drop it. Beautiful plate painted with pomegranates. I was given this because we got so excited about the temple 3 years ago in my old church, and this was a present from my group for me, just because I was obsessed with pomegranates. Pomegranates are a very beautiful thing, so I thought I'll bring in my plate and show them how beautiful pomegranates are. You know that if you go to the greengrocer. So you cut them in cross-section. They are beautiful, and there are 200 of these things carved across the top of the pillar. And I thought, actually, bringing the plate kind of fits the object, because the whole point is you don't get to see it. You've got to learn to picture it in your mind's eye as it's described. So I kind of ruined it. And I guess 200 pomegranates is better than a plate with a few pomegranates on. People have their imaginations captured by this in great architecture of the world. So if you've ever been to Barcelona, you will have been to the Sagrada de Familia, enormous cathedral built by Gaudi. In fact, he only completed sort of a tenth of it in his lifetime because it was so ambitious. They're still finishing it now. One of the things I love about the cathedral there is that he bases the design of it on nature, because he believes that God is the creator and the most beautiful things in all the world are the things that God's made. So we could make our own geometry and we come up with something like the gherkin or the, I suppose you could say that's based on nature, but I don't think they had a pickled cucumber in mind at the time, or the shard or the walkie-talkie, you know, whatever your famous favourite geometric London skyscraper shape is. But Gaudi said, no, the best shapes are God's shapes. Creation beats anything that we could come up with. And so the Sagrada de Familia Cathedral is based on the shape of a tree canopy. The pillars are meant to be like the pillars of trees. And inside, he's got bosses in the ceiling designed to look like honeycomb, because it's just amazing what bees can come up with as God's designed it. And you think, well, he's taken his inspiration from the temple. What is the temple decorated with? Pomegranates and flowers and shapes of trees and creatures with wings. It's all these beautiful things from the creative world that decorate the temple. In fact, there is even an argument that says that the reason that this building looks so good, I know from the inside it looks like a lecture theatre, but if you just look out the windows, I know you're tempted to do this anyway in a sermon, but across the way, and you can see the Queen's House, and similarly to the Royal Naval College, the Queen's House in classical architecture, There is an argument that classical architecture derives its patterns originally from the temple. That's why Greenwich looks so great. So the idea of having pillars, and at the top of pillars having a slightly bigger circle, and above that having a lattice that you decorate, you know, all the building blocks of classical architecture arguably come from the temple. And then the Babylonians raided the temple, and they got the idea to get to Babylon. And then along came the Greeks and the Romans, they put it into their buildings. And then along came Christopher Wren, clever Sir Christopher Wren, and he copied it to make the Royal Naval College. One of the reasons this looks so nice, arguably, it is a bit temple-like. But actually nothing can quite compare with the splendor of this house. I want to just pick out a couple of details that captured my imagination. Look back at chapter 6 and look at verse 7. When the house was built, it was with stone prepared at the quarry, so neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron was heard in the house while it was being built. So in other words, not only is this incredible building constructed, but it's constructed in absolute silence. And there's a kind of reverence even about the building site. Now, this is a very strange picture. Have you ever been to a London building site? I'm looking at James Hepton, who's back from Australia for the day, and he runs huge building sites, and they're quite noisy. That's why I guess you've got your ear protectors and whatever else to go around the site. But this one is such a holy building site that they prefab everything off-site, cut it to exactly the right size, and then bring it on-site, and they can slot it in near silence. No hammers, no chisels. I mean, it's hard enough to build it. To build it in silence, wow. Second thing that captured my imagination is that really absolutely everything in the house is made of gold. And I think as you read the description, you wonder whether the author's even cheated and described the same thing twice. But just look at verse 20, chapter 6, verse 20. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 20 cubits high. He overlaid it with pure gold. He also overlaid with gold an altar of cedar. And Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold, and he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. And he overlaid the whole house with gold. I'm sure you've already said that, but let me just remind you, it's overlaid with gold until the whole house was finished. And the whole altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary, can you guess? He overlaid with gold. I mean, this is bling, isn't it? This is the most gold that you've ever seen inside a building. And one of the things I love about it is that you build it out of really expensive materials only to overlay it with gold. They don't do that on modern building sites either. If you're going to have something faced with, say, nice veneer, then behind it you have MDF, or just steel. But this, they build things out of really expensive wood, like cedar. And then you're not even going to see the cedar because it's just behind the gold. It's like it's glorious from the inside out, because God, who sees everything, can enjoy this house. Final thing that I love is the massive cherubim. So verse 23, chapter 6. In the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. 5 cubits was the length of one wing. In other words, it's bigger than my arm stretched out. 5 cubits the length of the other wing of the cherub. It was 10 cubits from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other. So that's a cubit. This is 5 cubits. So imagine my arm sort of 2.5 times longer, like that. I'm an angel. And there's another angel to the side of me, and he does the same thing, and our wingtips touch. So this enormous arch made out of the wings of two angels, two cherubim, in the most holy place. And underneath is going to go the Ark of the Covenant containing the Ten Commandments, and they're going to place it beneath the cherubim. Of course, you remember from Exodus, the Ark also has cherubim on its lid. So you've got the cherubim here, and then the enormous cherubim above it. It would have looked spectacular, but of course, you don't even get to see. This is only the high priest can go in to see this. But we're told about it. We get access to it in these words. And God sees it, and the hope is he'll enjoy it. He'll find it a worthy place for his glory. Imagine Lloyd Grossman, those who remember his accent, saying, "What kind of person do you think lives here?" And you look at it and you think, someone incredibly glorious. Someone who loves the beauty of creation as a fitting tribute to him. Pomegranates and wings and lattice work and flower calyxes and so on and so on and so on. And then you also think, gosh, this must have been very, very expensive. We learnt last week about Solomon's income, about £1 billion per year. And you can see why that was necessary, because obviously most of that money, at least a big chunk of that money, is needed to finance this extraordinary building project. Well, we skip over those verses, and I just want us not to. They're there for a reason. And if you start to picture it in your mind's eye, you're supposed to go, wow, a glorious temple. And then most amazingly of all, God comes to dwell in this glorious temple. So just look across to chapter 8. And Cynthia read to us of the ark coming into the temple. Remember, the ark was the box containing the Ten Commandments, the stone tablets, and some of the manna that God had fed the people with in the wilderness. And it symbolized God's holy presence amongst his people, his covenant relationship, the promises he'd made that they would be his people and that he would be their God. The ark turns out to be quite powerful. If you've seen the film Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's very, very loosely based on that idea from the Bible. But it is a powerful ark. This ark defeats whole cities amongst the Philistines in the book of 1 Samuel. It's a powerful box symbolizing the presence of God, and they bring it into the temple. And when the ark comes into the temple, and they're carrying it on these big poles, they rest it in the most holy place, and the priests leave. And just look at what happens, chapter 8, verse 10. When the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. Now, I remember when I was at school learning about various different kinds of clouds. So I don't know if you remember the different kinds. There's the cirrus ones. They're the wispy little ones that are sort of curved really, really high up. And the altostratus, which are the flat ones but really, really high up. And then there's the cumulonimbus cloud, which means it's going to rain a lot. I hope you got your umbrella. But in the Bible, there's another kind of cloud. It's the God's glory cloud. And this cloud symbolizes God's presence amongst his people. You think of other famous places in the Bible that you had this pillar of cloud going through the wilderness. In front of them, there was a pillar of cloud. So I guess it's sort of rectangular column cloud, very distinctive. You'd notice it on the weather reports out the window. Oh, there's a cumulonimbus, there's an altostratus, and oh, there's God. And you can tell it's God because at night time, the cloud turned into a pillar of fire, and the daytime back to a pillar of cloud. And it went with them in all their wanderings through the wilderness. Then they built the tabernacle at the time of Moses, and the cloud came and filled the tabernacle. They carried the tabernacle with them in all of their journeys. And now they've come to Jerusalem. King Solomon is being established as the most powerful, the richest, the most glorious king ever. And he builds this temple, and the cloud comes and fills the temple. It means God is there amongst his people. Verse 13 of chapter 8, I've built for you an exalted house, a place for you to dwell in forever. Verse 16, he describes it as a house that my name might be there. Verse 19, you shall build the house for my name. Verse 20, I have built the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And God's name, God's presence, God's glory cloud comes to fill the house of the Lord. Wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, here we are with just words, listening in a nice Christopher Wren-designed maybe temple tribute kind of construction. But there's no cloud. And wouldn't it be amazing if you said, oh, sorry, you can't come into Grace Church Greenwich this week. Why? Oh, because it's full of a thick mist, and we've realized that's actually it's God's glory is filling the place, and we can't go in. Well, I don't think you'd be disappointed about church being cancelled that week. You'd be amazed. God's actually present with us in this tangible, visible way. How amazing. But notice that it's not easy to have God come and dwell near you if you're a sinner, if you're a rebel, if you're somebody with an unclean heart, an unclean lips, like all of us here. It's not just that you've got to build something really fancy. You know, Lord, I'm trying to persuade you to move in, so you'll notice I've put a lot of gold into it. I hope you won't mind living here. It's not just about the building. It's about the need for rescue. We're not a people fit to dwell, to live near God. He's a God too holy to live near us by nature. And so again and again, I don't know if you noticed it as we heard the readings, but again and again they're reminded of the way that God brought them out of the land of Egypt. I think we're told four times in the readings we've heard, just these extra excerpts. Chapter 6 once, chapter 8 three times. God brought them out of the land of Egypt. It's a reminder that the only reason they are living in a country so close to God's presence is because he's a rescuing God. Once they were far from him, once they lived far off in slavery, and God, by his mercy, saved them, rescued them, forgave them. Kieran mentioned it in his testimony, the wonderful, precious truth to know that there can be forgiveness and a slate wiped clean. And that's the reason that we can look forward to a perfect world in the presence of God. And God won't move in just if you make a house that's gold enough. God moves in because he rescues enough. He forgives enough to live close to us. Well, so far so good. What an amazing place. But what a disappointment, hey, that we weren't there. What a shame that we have to live now, about 3,000 years, just under 3,000 years too late to experience this. Wouldn't you want to swap your experience of a lecture theatre somewhere in the middle of Greenwich with the experience of the Israelites under Solomon with a temple? Well, maybe there's that temptation for us as readers. There wouldn't have been that temptation for the first readers of the book. Because as 1 and 2 Kings is first published and it's available in the bookshops and they get a copy, the first readers don't live in Jerusalem near this house. They live in exile because God had kicked them out of the promised land. And they know that by the end of this book, the house, this amazing, glorious house, starts to get smashed up. It's full of bronze pillars and gold doorposts and gold furnishings. But as you read on through the book of 1 and 2 Kings, we'll find that gradually it gets stripped of glory. It's a glorious house that gets de-glorified. Successive kings sell off bits of the temple, some of the furnishings, some of the gold on the doorposts. Eventually, there's no gold at all left, and so they start selling off the bronze. And eventually, there's no bronze left. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, comes to the house, and he burns it to the ground, and there's nothing left. And so as they read it, the first readers, there's a sense of wistfulness. We had this, and we lost it. We had God so close to us, but we were so evil, we were so persistent in our wrongdoing that God moved out. Some of us saw the same thing on Wednesday night in our grace groups. God said, I'm leaving. This is no longer a house fit for me to live in. So that as the first readers read it, there's a sense of wistfulness. But as the Christian reads it, there's a sense of fulfillment. Because in the New Testament, there comes a better house. Not built out of gold, doesn't have pomegranates decorating it. It's actually a person, son of a carpenter, a guy called Jesus Christ. And in this bizarre scene, he's visiting the temple. Actually, it's not this one, it's a sort of rebuild of this one. Jesus visits the temple, and in a bizarre scene, he challenges the people who are worshipping there and says, destroy this temple, and I'll build it in 3 days. And they say, I'm not sure you've appreciated the architectural complexity of this building. I mean, it took them years to build this temple, Jesus. And I know you fancy yourself as a miracle worker, but trust me, you're not going to be able to manage it in 3 days. And then the Bible author gives us the comment, but he wasn't talking about the temple. The temple he was talking about was his body. Destroy this temple, says Jesus, and I'll raise it again in 3 days. Kill me, in other words, and in 3 days later, I'll be raised from the dead. And I will be, my body will be the glorious place where God is content to dwell. It's not easy to live near God if you're a sinner. But Jesus says, my death and resurrection will be the rescue that you need to have me close to you. And then we're told in the New Testament that the church, as it's built on the foundation of Jesus as the cornerstone, we grow into a temple by in which God dwells by his Spirit. And when I say the church, I don't mean the church building. I mean the church people. Christians, as we come to Jesus, we become the house where God dwells. And what of it? So what's the benefit of knowing about the original physical house if we live at the time of the later spiritual built out of people Christian church house? Well, I think the same kind of questions. How glorious is this house made out of people? Actually, it's made out of building materials much more precious even than gold. Each brick of the house, a person that the Lord Jesus bought with his death to belong to him, each person. But we ought to look round and say, wow, this is really glorious. This is amazing. This is one of the wonders of the world in this room. Now, I know we would quite like to have a building. I mean, this is a nice place to meet. It'd be a great thing to have an actual building to call our own in Greenwich. All sorts of advantages in terms of set up and set down, advantages in terms of a presence all the way through the week, not just on a Sunday afternoon. Please do pray for that. Pray for a permanent home for us. But I think there's something good, isn't there, about being in this phase of our church's life where we don't have a building. We're just sort of nomadic. We camp out in a lecture room in a university. Because it's not that glorious, is it? Inside, it looks nice on the outside, but you know, no gold that I can see. No one's bothered to put pomegranates at the top of the... It's just very ordinary. And it reminds us that the real glory is this group of people that God is building. And that God has decided this is a fit place for him to live in each of us by his Holy Spirit. Not because we're gold enough, but because God's rescued us enough and saved us and forgiven us and cleansed us and come to dwell amongst us. And my question is, well, my first question was, do you appreciate how glorious this was? I've tried to show you this was an amazing, amazing place in history. But then do we realize and appreciate how glorious this is? That this is the group of people that God has said, I'll live amongst them. I'll make them my dwelling place. They are a fit place for the glory of my name to be manifested. Because I don't always think like that. I think, oh, it's church, I suppose. I better be going Sunday afternoon. Time for church. I don't think I'm about to go to God's temple, by which I don't mean the building, I mean the people. I'm about to meet with the people in whom God dwells. We're pretty ordinary in Greenwich. Most people don't even know we exist, probably, as they go about there. People know about the Old Royal Naval College. You find it on Google Maps. You find photos of it everywhere. And people come to Greenwich to see a building. If only they knew there is a spiritual house here in which God dwells, more glorious than any other. I didn't always think of it like that. Here is the house for my name. Here is the house for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. And here is the place where God comes to dwell in all his glory with the people he has rescued to be in relationship with him.